Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, October 28th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live.
Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. There I am. On the program today, we have Dave Weigel coming on to preview the midterms. And later in the show, we have
Matthew
Film Guy. Yeah, look at that. All right, go ahead.
On the program today, Dave Weigel.
Thought I was going to throw up there. I have no headlines in front of me.
What am I going to do? Will be joining us on the program today. Meanwhile, Nancy Pelosi's husband attacked with a hammer during a break-in, no word as to motive. Elon Musk takes over Twitter, fires its leadership, insists it will be self-driving within a year. Early voting up, but down amongst the youngins. Also on the program today, Arizona puts its abortion ban on hold. Supreme Court to hear a challenge to a 20-year ruling that colleges and universities can consider race in admitting a diverse student body. New numbers out. Economy grew in the third quarter, shattering predictions of a recession. For now, anyways. January 6th committee continues its work, apparently, interviewing the Secret Service agents. U.S. sends another $275 million in military aid to Ukraine. And the DOJ announces a new policy which dramatically increases protections for journalists who possess or publish classified information. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us. It is a casual Friday, and you can tell because of the soft-collared shirt that I am wearing and the general casual feeling emanating from Emma Vigeland.
Hello, yeah, I don't change it up much with the wardrobe for Friday. I guess I should find some sort of like special outfit, but that seems like too much effort.
Then they wouldn't be casual.
Right.
Yeah, anyway, because, yeah, exactly. If you spend too much time on it, I would just maybe just like take something out of the laundry.
Okay, so show up dirty to the office is what you I mean, what you'd like. You'd like me to smell. All right, that's casual.
I mean, I don't, it's not a requirement. I mean, I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt.
You are the boss, and you're telling me I should do something. This is how power works. But
let's get right into it, folks. The theme for today has been what's going I guess will be what's going on with these poll numbers and what's going on with the dichotomy between the broad narrative that we're hearing from the Beltway media, if you will, and what the poll numbers say. A lot of people are pointing this out with a piece in the New York Times where it was attempting to prove that Democrats were weakening in their position by showing polls that showed that Democrats were not weakening in their position. People got confused by this. Hopefully Dave Weigel can sort some of this out for us. In the meantime, it makes this sort of supposed hot mic moment. And I say supposed because I always say supposed before a hot mic moment because I'm a little skeptical regardless of what that hot mic moment is. My sense is usually when we hear things in this context, it's not always a mistake. But also, granting Chuck Schumer some notion of, like, you know, some characteristics, some Machiavellian
strategery
characteristics,
yeah,
are very hard for me to do.
Right.
With that said, here is a what appears to be a hot mic moment where Chuck Schumer is letting Joe Biden know that things are looking a little bit better than maybe one might expect.
Yes. That seat, we're in danger of that seat. So, no, fine. It looks like the debate didn't hurt us as much in Pennsylvania as it did, so that's good. And we're basically picking up steam on that.
All right. Now that's very difficult to hear, and it would have been. The gist of it was Schumer telling Biden, looks like the debate didn't hurt us too much in Pennsylvania as of today. That was yesterday. So that's good, which great analysis. And he says we're picking up steam in Nevada, which obviously is a very important. Catherine Cortez Masto looked like she was beginning to fall behind. I don't know what picking up steam in Nevada means, but it's better than losing steam in Nevada. And he's saying the state where we're going downhill is Georgia, where he says it's hard to believe that they will go for Herschel Walker. And it is, but it's possible. It feels a little bit like Stacey Abrams' campaign is having problems, and that is inhibiting or impacting the Warnock-Walker race, but very difficult to tell. There's also been enormous early voting in Georgia, but that's also difficult to assess because we've never had a midterm election after the pandemic where people's voting habits may have changed. And so the usual benchmarks maybe aren't. So it's all a little bit difficult, but that's what Chuck Schumer thinks, apparently. And he's
apparently
not afraid to let people know.
The other thing that's difficult to assess is how much is he sucking up to the president, where this is his job to oversee the maintenance of a Democratic majority in the Senate. So
that's
he could
point.
Be painting a rosier picture than might actually be the case.
I mean, it wouldn't necessarily explain the Herschel Walker comment if that was the case. And also, it's not like, and maybe he's just hoping that if he says this to Biden today, Biden in a week won't remember, and it won't make a difference what the results are in terms of his reliance on what Schumer says. But we are only now seven business days out, less than 2 weeks, folks. I mean, let's not get until the midterm elections. And in a moment, we'll have Dave Weigel on to give us a sense of what his assessment of both the polls are, but also what he's hearing out on the campaign trail. But first, a couple of words from our sponsors. First off, for me now, like, everything is full on habit. Right. And I don't mean like, I've always had some issues with like being too habitual. Like back in the day, I used to get complaints from people who worked around me that I would wear the same pants every day, which of course was a lie because I had two identical pairs of pants and I would switch off between them. But the point is, What I'm now
that good, makes it so much better.
Well, what I'm doing now is
you should sue them for
I'm
libel.
Trying to make. I'm trying to adopt more and more good habits and make them habits. Okay, like I'm doing a little bit of calisthenics in the morning, and I'm trying to make a habit of that. And of course, the big one over the past, I would say, like 6-7 years, really that I have made is oral hygiene habits. And one of the ways that has been a huge boon for me is Quip. Quip electric toothbrush uses time vibrations, has 30-second pulses, so it gives you the dentist-recommended 2-minute clean. You have to divide your face up into 4 sections. People can figure that out. And now they even you can upgrade with a new smart motor to track and improve your brushing and earn sweet rewards. You build your whole routine with even more Quip products like reusable floss pick or the refillable mouthwash. All right, so here's the point. The Quip toothbrush, beautifully designed. It is a nice design for a toothbrush, but it's also like it functions like a regular toothbrush. You don't need a huge machine to sit on your counter. You don't have to travel with like four sets of batteries. It functions like a toothbrush. So it makes it easier for you to maintain your habit. And here's the other part about it. Quip delivers brush heads, fresh floss, and other refills every month from just $5, no extra shipping costs. So in other words, you ran out of your floss, you don't break the habit because they send you more. Now, of course, I've also, my amazement at the refillable flosser, I don't think will ever ebb or flow, but they have other great products. It's a wonderful design company that focuses on dental hygiene. My kids, my extended family members, they all have Quips because of me, because I told them to get it. I mean, I buy it for my kids. They're not going to buy their own toothbrush. If you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you're going to get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/majority. That's spelled GETQUIP.com/majority. Quip, the good habits company. And lastly, our favorite sponsors, sunsetlakesabade.com. Left is best. Gets you 20% off. 20% off all of their Sabade products. They've got those gummies with the THC and the Sabade. Just a reminder, I got to say the letters weirdly because of YouTube, but be that as it may, they have third-party documentation. All of their products are tested, so you know exactly what's in it, what the makeup of each of their products is, whether it's your smokables, whether it's your pre-rolls, your keef, whether...
whether it's the gummies,
yeah, you got this. That,
the gummies, the which I literally used the tincture last night to go to sleep because I love the tincture with the melatonin in it. It really does help me, honestly, and I don't have to, you know, ever think about need
I'm
sleep.
Back. Sorry,
you're back. Okay,
sorry, I don't know what the hell is going on today. Sabade gummies, and they have Sabade coffee and. All of these products and partners, they have wonderful farming practices. They have great employment practices, $20 minimum wage, a mostly employee-owned company. And they have been incredibly supportive of all the from food pantries to refugee resettlement to Innocence Project. Just a great company all around. SunsetLakeSabade.com. Left is best gets you 20% off. Left is best gets you 20% off. All right. Just a... okay. So we're having a little bit of trouble locating Dave.
Yes, he just told me he's on a deadline. He's running a little late, so...
He's on 2 deadlines
yeah,
now.
Yeah,
apparently.
Seriously. He said he had a noon deadline, so I'm just going to keep getting.
Okay, well, let's cover a couple of these debates. In there have been mixed reports as to what's happening in New Hampshire. Maggie Hassan is still in the lead, but the Republican National Reelection Committee jumped out, then jumped back in terms of providing funds for Don Bolduc. I mean, this is going to be the whole night when we're covering this is going to be a whole series of essentially like harbingers, right? I mean, if Don Bolduc is in the lead in New Hampshire, it's going to be a bad night, I think, for Democrats. Here is Don Bolduc, who has gone back and forth multiple times as to his election denialism. When he was in the primary, he was absolutely sure there was evidence that the election was stolen. A couple of weeks later, after he won the primary, he talked to people in the Granite State and he realized the election was actually legitimate. And then he went on a podcast or two about a week or two after that and said, actually, there's some questions about the election. And here he is trying to sort of like, I don't know, do both.
With me is Amanda Gokey of New Hampshire Bulletin. We'll continue now with a discussion on voting and elections. General, this week, you know, earlier, a couple of days ago, yesterday, I think, you said you'd accept the results of next month's vote, you know, regardless of how it went for you. Referring to the 2020 election, you said, quote, I still believe there were irregularities and fraud, and I believe that it can be proven even in this state. You know, there is no evidence of widespread fraud in New Hampshire. The governor and the secretary of state both say New Hampshire elections were secure and not compromised by fraud. Do you believe they're wrong? 60 seconds.
Well, I believe Rance Daters, right? And I'm the only one sitting here that's been to every town and city in this state over 2 years. And I believe Granite Staters when they say they don't like the fact that college students that aren't residents here can vote. They don't like the fact that they can't trust the mail-in ballot system. They don't like the fact that there was proven irregularities with voting machines that haven't been certified in 20 years. They don't like the fact that same-day voter registration causes fraud. If Granite Staters don't like it, then we need to take a look at it. But what she believes in is federalizing the process. I don't believe in that at all. More big government. That's all she's been talking about. Big government. Not only does she believe in federalizing that, but she wants to take away our Electoral College. It would hurt New Hampshire. She voted for that in SB1. She can't hide from that. That's her vote. And that would also take first in the state primary away, something that brings about $4 billion every 4 years to the people of New Hampshire.
We're going to get to some of that.
This is huge.
We're going to get to some of that in a moment.
So this is huge. So I listen to Granite Staters. I don't want the federal government in your business.
All right. We're going to get to that. I do have a follow-up, though. You mentioned you want to eliminate same-day voter registration in New Hampshire.
No, I want the state to look at it.
Okay, well, this is what you said. Okay.
I want the state to look at it. I want our state legislators and governors to look at it because the Heritage Foundation found that we ranked 21 in voter integrity.
All right, let me just get to the question here, though. The question is that if you eliminate that, then New Hampshire would need to follow so-called motor voter requirements federally, which would essentially have voters register anytime they got a driver's license. Is that something that you favor?
No, you can balance that. And again, the federal government needs to stay out of
elections. All right. We don't, I mean, honestly, like the, I mean, I actually think this is going to be somewhat effective there, right? Because he managed to evade the entire question and to replace it with look at, which, I mean, presumably when they pass a law in New Hampshire, they look at what they're passing the law on. But if you keep saying they need to look at it, it makes you sound like you're reasonable. I'm just calling for people to look at it.
Just concerns, yeah.
Look at it.
Look under the bed, mom and dad.
And also
the monster down there.
The point that he was making about, and the audio was kind of choppy. That wasn't on our end. That was from the debate. But the point that he was making too about or trying to connect her wanting to eliminate the Electoral College to that New Hampshireans losing some sort of control over the primary process, because that is true. New Hampshire, Iowa, they have an outsized role in the presidential primary. From a national perspective, that's not a good thing, but that might resonate with a few people in New Hampshire as well.
Yeah, and it's Granite Sanders.
Oh, Granite Sanders. And not just the primary process, I should say, you know, because the Electoral College or whatever, brain fart, but the Electoral College as well gives them an outsized influence over the presidential race in general.
Yeah, we'll see. I think just the bottom line is, you know, with New Hampshire, the idea of less involvement from the federal government has some resonance in that state because of the big influx of libertarians in that state and, you know, basically people from Massachusetts trying to escape taxes. And that has a big influence on the voting there. All right. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Dave Weigel. He is the author of Americana newsletter at Semaphore. When we have him, he can tell you what semaphore means. sounds very, very suspicious.
Yes.
We'll be right back after this. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Dave Weigel. Last time you were with us, Dave, and by us, I mean, of course, Emma and I. Thank
Hello.
You. You were working for the Washington Post, and now you're working for this organization called Semaphore. What's that all about?
Is this the Illuminati? I mean, come on, Dave.
Well, they're all the Illuminati. It's all the media. We have the same meeting every Tuesday at noon, just to the all hands to figure out what the narrative is this week. But it's a startup with a bunch of journalists who have worked at other places and thought, okay, there's some issues here where people don't trust the media, not just for Republicans ginning it up reasons, but for hey, this coverage is awful reasons. And we kind of have a different sort of format where we break down like our analysis from the reporting, which has been pretty fun. We're very scoops focused. I mean, I've been the last couple of weeks doing the same thing I've been doing for like a decade, which is just going to places, talking to candidates, writing stories. So I have more of that coming. But it has been good. And like the Post is fine. Everyone should keep reading it. We're just trying something new. But I have found there's Republicans who didn't want to talk to me at the Post who will talk to me now, which I feel like is unfair to the Post, but yeah, good for me.
Right. Well, I do enjoy like the little David's View thing at the end of. I mean, I like that. I like the explicitness. It gives you guys license to be explicit about your perspective on this. All right. Well, let's start with. You brought it up. Let's start with this whole question of like the narrative that you guys get together with on Tuesdays to determine as a and there's like a lot of controversy around this Nate Cohn assessment piece. I guess that was a function of four House races, which ostensibly has gone from showing that Democrats are in trouble to showing that Democrats have some hope. He points out Pennsylvania's eighth, Kansas is third, New Mexico's second, and Nevada's first. Broadly speaking, let's just start with this and then we can go into this. Where are we relative to the polls? Because the narrative has been Democrats are in increasingly bad shape. But the polls don't seem to reflect that in terms of like the generic polls or maybe, you know, specific polls around the country.
Yeah, I thought this set of polls was good because it validated a theory I've had from really from going around the country, which is in places where suburban voters with college degrees, suburban women, where people are not, you know, maybe they were doing better at some point in their lives, but they're not like destitute right now. In those places, people are still very focused on abortion, on threats of that. In red states in particular, where Republicans, when they're taking power, are banning abortion, or if they're winning the election, they're going to do it. In bluer places, especially kind of working class Democratic districts, either white working class or black or Hispanic, Democrats are doing worse. And they're doing worse, again, in states where Democrats run everything. That's been this theme. The part of that, the demographic stuff, I kind of saw popping over the summer. The rest of it I didn't see until recently. I mean, I think there was inconsistency between, you know, if you're in Michigan or New York or whatever, Democrats were doing really well saying, don't let Republicans win because they're going to ban abortion. It is, I think Republicans have had more luck switching the issues around in New York, for example, in Michigan a little bit, in places where they say, don't worry about it. I mean, the Republican message on abortion has evolved into, don't worry about it, and also Democrats want babies to be killed as they're crowning. Those two things have been a little more effective. You can't really say that when you're in Kansas and Oklahoma is right underneath you and they literally banned abortion. You cannot say don't worry about it there.
That's interesting. So, I mean, it's conceivable with what the picture you're drawing is that we're going to have a very unique where we see the distribution of races that may flip in the House. It's going to be it's going to be a unique off-year election because generally we have these sort of like what we consider to be frontline districts mm-hmm. that are in purplish states or they're purplish districts. But like we've got Sean Patrick Maloney, who is the DCCC chair, who bigfooted Mondaire Jones and basically stepped into his district so that he could lock up mm-hmm. his victory. Mm-hmm. And he seems to be, at the very least, in enough jeopardy that the Republicans are expending their resources there. Like, what is that? Is that yeah. like indicative of this of the situation?
And Democrats are spending some resources. Yeah, that one too. Because and I was in the district during the primary. During that primary, and there are a couple others in the region. Maloney had after Mondaire Jones moved to the city, he had Alessandro Biaggi, the state senator. From Westchester County is running against her. And he was saying at the time, like, this is some stuff I represented in the new stuff, which is like Rockland County, you know, other side of the Hudson from Westchester. He's like, that's going to be tough. And it is tough. And so you have a Republican Assemblyman member there who's pretty well known. And it's just been a relentless crime message, which getting to what we were saying before, I think has been pretty effective because in New York, Democrats do run everything. So you sound silly, or at least you sound silly to me and you, if somebody says Democrats run the federal government, like, oh yeah, that's why all the stuff they want is passing through the Senate. Good point. But in New York, they can say that. And the big hit on Maloney has been, hey, when this guy ran for attorney general in 2018, he supported cashless bail. And, you know, you guys talked about this, like the way that cashless bail has been bolderized, the complexity of the policy, how it's like, instead of just giving people a dollar sum, we're going to rate their dangerousness. You know, if you get busted for like some weed in a place where it's not legal, you're going to be treated differently than somebody who shoved somebody from a subway platform. The Republican ad version of this is cashless bail equals rapists coming to your door immediately. And so that has been pretty effective in New York. It has been less effective. You mentioned Pennsylvania, a little bit less effective in like Scranton because Republicans run the state legislature and everybody knows, like, that's the Democrats didn't do, like, Larry Krasner exists, but, like, if you're a Democrat in Scranton, you weren't doing any of the stuff that they've demonized there. Complicated. I mean, like, they've really been going after them. Crime's not the only issue. I just think that one has been popping differently and abortion's been popping differently depending how blue or red the state is.
The crime thing is fascinating because you and Benji Sarland, I think it is, who is also now at Semaphore, wrote a piece about Gallup showing that people's concern about crime is as high as it's been in decades. crime isn't as high as it's been in decades, but it has gone up through COVID. And I mean, is crime really up that much in Westchester? I mean, that's the thing. It's like, it's just a sort of like general overall sort of anxiety that seems to me to be almost like, you know, the caravan in 2018.
Yeah, there's a lot of social science on this that was really fun to go into. Like every time I link a paper that's 53 pages, I'm surprised. Oh, people don't want to read the whole thing. But yeah, in Westchester County, not as much. You do have powerful tabloids, powerful local news in New York, where every time a crime happens, there's, you know, the angles of it. There's the security cam footage, front page of the New York Post, and then it gets splashed in the Fox News. I mean, just the media like funnel system for crime news is just enormous. Any crime story, and maybe a crime story that might not have been front page when like Trump was president, not around the country, because what was the narrative? You know, the narrative is maybe it's de Blasio's fault or something. That gets blown up big. But I've heard from Republicans a bunch of places. I was in Wisconsin writing one of those stories a couple weeks ago, and they were saying, you know, not one on the record, really. The Republican running for attorney general was saying, like, yes, well, crime is not up everywhere. If you're in rural Wisconsin, I mean, there's counties where it was like higher 4 years ago and it's lower now. And there's some where there was a fluke, you know, one thing where five people died, but then no crime this year. But Milwaukee is up 70%. And crimes from Milwaukee get statewide coverage. The impression people have, if you're, you know, even 3 hours, 4 hours away from Milwaukee, is that Democrats have turned the city into Mad Max. I point out that this Waukesha parade killing, and the killer was convicted this week, Darryl Brooks. Republicans have just run millions and millions of dollars just showing that imagery again and again, to the complaints of some people, and saying this is because Democrats in Milwaukee have like anti-police sentiments and they have light bail systems. So even when it's not crime happening next to you, it is messaged that way. And the other thing, in some places, there are social sciences mentioned, was disorder and crime are different things. Disorder is, I go outside on the street and there's a tent there and I feel unsafe because it's a homeless person, who knows what's going to happen. There are people who are not victims of crime per se, but they think things have gotten worse and they think that could spiral into crime. And that feeds in when you see a story about a person with mental issues pushing somebody on a subway train. Like the mindset, you can walk your way through it. Like that has been happening in some of these places where even if there's not crime from day to day, you see B-roll. I mean, Fox News has lots of this B-roll of the tents, B-roll of people shooting up in the streets. And the idea is, I think the meta idea over this is Democrats had a promise that we're going to reform. We're going to listen to protesters and reform the criminal justice system a little bit, and crime went up. Therefore, Democrats literally are killing you. You need to get rid of them. They will not solve these problems. We will. That is kind of clicking everywhere. And sometimes polls say that crime is not the top issue, but in the paid messaging, it really is relentless.
Well, can you talk about Wisconsin a little bit more specifically? Because you mentioned that footage that's being used against Mandela Barnes in particular, but one, he's a black candidate, right?
Yeah.
So that the crime messaging from Ron Johnson, I feel like, is racially coded and probably hits a little bit differently in Wisconsin. But he's literally saying, you know, Mandela Barnes responsible for inciting violence and things like that at debates. And what has that been the focus of Johnson's campaign now, when he was kind of struggling a few months ago a little bit to coalesce behind a message and didn't have an answer for gay marriage or abortion or anything like that? Has this kind of been where he's focused now?
Yeah, a big focus of that campaign. And what has happened there and a couple other places is statements about criminal justice reform and about nonviolent criminals, things that Republicans might have said 3 years ago or 2 years, not 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when Donald Trump was gearing up for reelection, you know, the First Step Act, he was very happy to talk about it. There's Democrats who just said things about how, hey, there's a lot of nonviolent prisoners who have been, or people who've been rehabilitated. We can let them out without causing more crime. And that is kind of being thrown back at people. Barnes said a lot of that. There is, and I asked him, do you think this advertising campaign is racist? It's hard for a candidate to say that without, you know, blowing up the news cycle and making it it's very fraught. You know, it's one of those questions you ask a candidate, you know, there's not a perfect answer. But he said, yeah, I think they found a good foil. He thinks they found somebody who they can splice together with a scary criminal in an ad. But they're doing that with John Fetterman. They're doing that with like any Democrat who endorsed this stuff. They're also in many cases just like lying, which I think is a key part of this. But I in a lot of these debates, especially House debates, I see Republican candidates just say, my opponent like is putting criminals back on the street. And they're talking to like a Democrat who never did that. I mean, there was not a, the extent they did it was they supported the First Step Act, which Donald Trump supported. Sometimes they just kind of make it up. Like there was a Claudia Tenney was debating her Democratic opponent over the last week. I mean, the video kind of was circulating yesterday, and she says, my opponent's supported by Bernie Sanders, who champions defund the police. Like, literally the opposite. If you were covering this in 2020, Bernie was in, they got in some hot water with activists because he got asked about defund, and he's like, this is a terrible idea. Here's my letter to the Biden administration, how we need, like, more police funding, but more accountability. He never said defund. He, like, adamantly was against defund many times, and they just say, yeah, well, he's for defund. Just, I'm going to say it and get away with it in this debate. So, like, Democrats are getting hit on the fronts of both, like, everything from just flat-out lying to actual decisions they made, because there are. I mean, this is everybody's nightmare if you're a progressive prosecutor. You let somebody out of prison. You let 500 people out of prison. One of them reoffends, and the whole project is challenged, right? That's been happening. That was happening in San Francisco. And then in the middle, you got people who just were for criminal justice reform that everyone supported, everyone, Republican, Democrat, did like a few years ago. And now that is being turned against them as this person wants you to die. This person wants criminals out of prison. You know, Fetterman example, the main example is he'll say you could let a third of people out of prison and crime wouldn't go up. He is talking very clearly about, you know, you can let the guy who got busted with a joint or the right. guy who just couldn't make bail because he had a bunch of speeding tickets. You can let that guy out and people won't die. They've turned that into he wants to let a third of prisoners out. Prisoners ipso facto include murderers, the Boston bomber, it's really, and I think also we're all kind of desensitized, but Republicans were not this blatant about this stuff in the last few years. They were in the 80s. It has really ramped up in a very kind of proud, I wouldn't say shameless, but like a very Trumpy way. Like I'll watch some of these ads and I'll say, you know, it was seven years ago at this point, Trump says like, Mexico's bringing, drugs and rapists over the border, and there's a sense that that is offensive and he shouldn't do that. Maybe people will react negatively. And I just see that messaging everywhere. You know, like, here's a scary criminal. Here's a border wall. Immigrants coming in the country means you're going to die of fentanyl poisoning. Like, that is just mainstream now.
And this may be a little bit outside of your portfolio, but I mean, it does feel to me like the relentlessness of the right over the past really 2+ years of like sort of reassessing the Black Lives Matter protest of 2020, reassessing this stuff and hammering it has been very effective. And I think on some level, you know, even the stuff like with their January 6th, in the absence of, when Democrats went away in the month of August, essentially in September on January 6th, it felt like it to the extent that January 6th hearings had built up some momentum and there was some cohort of people who were concerned about, you know, threats to democracy and Republican leaders who were not acknowledging what happened on that day. That seems to have at least dissipated, at least in the context of the narrative. And I feel like a similar thing happened in terms of police reform. I just saw something today. I think I can't remember what school it was. A university had committed to doing some program to assess racial injustice. And now they're dialing that back. Like, yeah. It feels like there was the classic thing that happens with Democrats. They win a presidential election and then it's everybody goes to sleep and says we solved it and we don't have to worry about it until the next Donald Trump or George W. Bush gets elected.
I think they've actually been pretty responsive on a lot of this stuff. I mean, I've been pointing out, like, Wisconsin, again, the Democratic position there, the governor, the attorney general, both want more funding for police. And you can, part of this is just, you're right, the momentum people had for reform or ideas that were just not, let's put more people in prison, that is gone, that is reversed. But Democrats have been prepared, and they've been messaging on this. They've not been lazy. I mean, the January 6th commission exists. It got media attention. There is, I think, this sort of a self-hating, masochistic tone in a lot of the coverage, though. Not the coverage, but like the columns about it, the take industry, where no matter how compelling something is for January 6th, the test is, well, there's a Trump voter in a Waffle House who's not going to find this interesting. Right. So this isn't real. Whereas a ad that is bashing somebody for saying you should free some nonviolent prisoners, well, this might affect the guy who voted for Biden, but also eats in a Waffle House. So that is real. And so I think that Democrats are having a problem convincing people that all of this, I mean, I don't know what the climate would be if inflation was at 2%. But I'm not sure it would be that different because yes, there are various economic problems, but if you go back to other midterms that held under conditions like gas has been higher for people in some elections that the incumbent party did fine in, interest rates were higher. Like in 1974, inflation was double digits. I mean, it's never hit double digits under Biden. It hit double digits under Nixon. And like Democrats were able to like do a, you know, sorry. There were incumbents who were able to win in those years. I think it's the media environment is the new thing, and Republicans have a very effective operation that when there are things that are real, I mean, it is real, like people don't like having to pay more for something than they did 2 years ago. But the idea that that is a crisis that you just need to flip the blue switch to red and that will fix it. I think a function of the media dominance of the right, because there's not like a, I can't tell you what the Republican plan to fight inflation is. And I can tell you some of the ideas that they propose are things that when they're tried in other countries, like what just happened in the UK, when somebody says, all right, in this moment of inflation, we're going to cut taxes. Markets say, wait, no, that's wrong. That is the opposite. That will actually increase inflation.
Yes. More money is, I think, in.
That's a thing that I think this media environment does. And I'm not saying, oh, poor, helpless Democrats, just, that is a thing about political coverage that somebody who, like, you know, joined a startup to do different coverage. I think that's something that people rightly find annoying, is that the conversation is not, what is this plan? How will it affect inflation? It is, why are Democrats losing in the polls? Why are Democrats not being taken seriously? And the question you see is, hey, you're a Democrat. Why should they vote for Joe Biden given that inflation is up? And there's no contrasting of like, what are you going to do? What were their plan? What Republican plan do? But again, the reality is Democrats have been like, I think the problem is they said that this is transitory. It wouldn't be a huge issue. Right. They've identified some problems. They fixed some problems. But that they were overconfident. I mean, if you asked a Democrat a year ago, would inflation be 8% by the election? They would think no, because of all the the way that the supply chains were going to be fixed, and they were, inflation was still up. But some of it, you got to feel, I mean, I said, you don't have to feel sorry for Democrats. Sometimes I do, because what's the Fed doing to fight inflation is raising interest rates. What did that result in? Oh, now you have campaign ads saying mortgages are higher than ever.
Right.
For reasons.
Rent. And rents are too.
More rent. Like that.
I mean, I guess, and I certainly was one of those people who a year ago did not think that this inflation would be as durable. But I also still contend, when you look at the inflation numbers from around the globe, that this is not a function of monetary inflation, where we have too much demand. We have gone through like a worldwide shock to supply lines, and in addition to having obviously a war going on, and that story, it seems to me they've been a little bit late in feeling like they needed to address that, that like make it clear that like we're going through this, but you know, there's only so many umbrellas to hand out when it's raining. Like what's happening now is not a function of policy or absence of policy, or at least one that can be addressed so quickly. Like, and part of it, I think, is we have a problem in expressing what inflation is, because there's, you know, we have, again, monetary inflation where there's just too much money sloshing around for the number of goods. Or we have inflation that is a function of supply lines. Like, you know, I use this example all the time. Like, you don't go down to parts in Florida where Hurricane Ian is hit and said, like, we have inflation because bottles of water are now selling for twice as much as they did before before we got hit with this hurricane, or that, you know, sandbags are more expensive. No, it's because there was a massive sort of like disaster that we weren't quite in a position to deal with.
Yeah. I mean, we're seeing the return of this talking point you saw when Obama was president, which was, when you took over, gas was this much, and now it's this much. It's like, well, what happened in between, you know, January 2009 and November 2012? There was a global recession, and it ended, and demand came back. Same thing happened this time. And so, again, I'm not trying to like do advertising for Democrats, but like Biden will say something like, gas prices are coming down. Republicans will say, yes, but they were lower a year and a half ago. The point is that they're coming down in the last few weeks, and you see Democrats kind of reach and grabs reality. I think an overall problem, and I've talked to Bernie Sanders about this, which is going to be up in Semaphore today. His idea is that Democrats just need to shift the conversation with an actual policy, which is we need to say inflation is the fault in part of companies taking advantage of the moment, keeping prices high and yes, and getting profits. So we need a windfall profits tax. And he's like, and he was saying, Republicans will never do that. It's, you can outflank them on that, because they're going to say inflation's bad. You can say, well, we should tax, just Shell doubled its profits, we should tax that. And what is the Republican response going to be? You know, some version of it's Biden's fault. But they're not doing that. This White House doesn't do that. There are candidates who do it. There are candidates who don't, because they have a pollster who say, well, people don't believe that, because, and you get into this Ouroboros of, you know, the news cycle and the Fox News existing. Well, our polls tell us that voters don't believe that, because they've heard that inflation is Biden's fault. So some of them, they can't change the conversation. But I keep mentioning the UK situation, because they're also, capital has the ability to strike and change policy. Like, it does it, it does it in South America all the time, does it around the world, just did it in the UK. And some every government that is at all progressive, at all leftist, not that this is a leftist government, but is trying something that is shifting the balance of the economy and trying to take more from the wealthy. There are things that like companies can do, and we've seen that in a few cycles. I mean, the version of this when Obama was president is, oh, these businesses are not investing much because they're uncertain about the tax picture. What they want is a very favorable regime where they make lots of money and their taxes are low, and they can, you know, protest when that's not happening. You and I can talk about that, and people can post about that. That's not the Democratic message. And, you know, what is the issue there? Is there a reason why Democrats can't blame corporations very clearly for raising prices? I was, you know, talking around it. I think it's just, they're not in a vacuum. They're in a media environment where they're one voice shouting that, and 99 voices are saying, it's because you passed the Inflation Reduction Act. That's what did it. I mean, I don't know how much you quote Ross Douthat on the show, but I do think a point he made that was right, mm-hmm, is, like Biden at the start of his presidency delivered on reversing some of the Trump border policies and ending the Keystone Pipeline. If you look at the actual Biden immigration policy since then, it's been pretty strict. If you look at the energy policy, it's been much more liberal in terms of granting leases than what he ran on, or what any Democrat ran on. But because those people remember those, and Republicans talk about those, the Republican message is, why is your gas cost more? Well, this one time, remember when Biden canceled the Keystone Pipeline? Remember when Biden canceled the Keystone Pipeline? Repeat 5 million times. And that I don't know if Democrats have the ability to say, well, actually, it's this, not even that complicated set of factors. Actually, it's gouging. Why can't they say it's gouging? It's not that he canceled this pipeline. Why can't they say it's the Saudis? Because this is another thing I talked about with Sanders. It's the Saudis cutting the supply. That's the reason it did it. That's true. Like, OPEC cutting the supply is a reason that gas prices went up. The war in Russia. But I don't have all the answers here, because I'm saying this are stuff that is true that Democrats could talk about. They don't. Is it their fault because they're just bad at politics, which is an argument? Or is that like they just can't? They are just like trapped under glass, banging on the glass underwater because the conservative messaging is so good that they can't break through. I think it's a combination. They're both bad and it's hard.
It may be hard, but we would have been able to assess that if the Democrats had attempted to do it in earnest, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, Warnock on two separate occasions in his debate with Walker mentioned corporate profits, but it was like almost an afterthought. Like, I mean, if you're going to message it, you've got to message it and you've got to really hit it. And again, if Warnock's the only one doing it, then it's a problem. But if you have 25, you know, Democratic senators going out there and saying this every day, and you have House leaders and Senate leaders talking about corporate profits, if Biden, you know, was to bring in the CEOs of, you know, 20 of these companies and go, you guys are gouging. There's no way that you should be making record profits in this situation. Like, you know, that's a concerted effort. If that doesn't work at that point, then I think, you know, we have solved that riddle as to, you know, is it that they're bad at politics or it is a bad media environment? But they never attempted to do it. And
not consistently. You're right. They would say it. And sometimes I'll, because I watch the debates and I watch the ads, I'll think, well, they actually did it. People, you know, people are not giving, but you need to do it consistently, right?
Yeah, you need to message it.
Don't finish a sentence without saying my opponents want to defund the police.
Yeah. Exactly. All right. So broadly speaking, you, in terms of the House, where do you think we're at this point? Like, I mean, we had the Siena College polling that Cohn wrote about those four races. Democrats are up in all of them except for Nevada's first, and Titus, as far as I know, hasn't run a competitive campaign against a Republican in I don't know how many years, multiple
terms.
Well,
since they redistricted, so not since 2010, really. Yeah, not since. So she comes back when they create a safe Vegas seat. So it's been a while. Yeah.
So I mean, not necessarily adept at campaigning. I mean, what we're trying to do is get a sense of like, is there a national trend, right? As opposed to like sort of the secular party out of power loses seats. What's your sense of this, at least in terms of the House?
Yeah, so there are a couple different kinds of Democrats who are in trouble. I mean, Republicans are in a great position to win the House, but the Democrats in trouble are people in districts that are very hard to hold on to, like if Biden won by less than 10. There's Democrats in districts that sometimes are safer than that, who have never had to run, who not had a hard run a hard race either ever or recently, and they've made some stumble. I was just in Texas, where that's one of the issues there is like the first or second cycle where some of these guys have had to run hard and they're screwing some stuff up. They've got, you know, scandals that no one paid attention to, and suddenly opposition researchers turn on them. And then there's, you know, then there's Democrats who are, you know, in tough races and are good at running tough races. Democrats a month ago felt much better. They felt more of their candidates were in that zone, right? They'll talk about Abigail Spanberger. They'll talk about Alyssa Slotkin, et cetera, who are ready for a ton of money to dump on there. That's the main thing is, do you raise a lot of money? Do you go on the air early to define yourself? Are you ready when they come at you? They're all very good at that. It's just this combination of issues is so new that I think all those categories, like those first two categories of Democrats, have been in trouble. Like the ones who are breaking out of the pack, we'll know after November 8th who was actually good at this. but they have done, frankly, like a lot of hippie punching, a lot of I'm not like those other Democrats, a lot of embracing, you know, saying in like I voted with Trump on this, things that make people angry online, but do still kind of click. And they've, you know, taken advantage of their opponent's weakness. It's been very hard for Democrats kind of everywhere. But I was saying this at the beginning, you are seeing people in places where it's like a suburb of a state where Republicans run everything. And Texas doesn't have many close races, but you know, you've got Democrats doing pretty good in Kansas, like pretty good in Oklahoma for governor, just places where Republicans run everything. It's very clear that they're going to do unpopular right-wing stuff if they win. They're doing better generally. Democrats are doing kind of worse overall. And the thing that I think scares Democrats this week is there's people who they thought were in the we got this on lock, we've run tough campaigns before category, who in the final weeks, once a group spends $200 million, not that much, but you know.
Right, right.
$10 million. Like Richard Uihlein can say, hey, things look good, here's another $10 million. Remember this in 2018, like Sheldon Adelson would give like $50 million several times to these Republican PACs. Like, there is stuff that is moving. The one thing, the problem they don't have is they really don't have a turnout issue right now. They're a little bit worried about youth turnout, but this is not like 2014 where they could not convince people there is an election happening. They're pretty good at the turnout. It looks more like Virginia 2021, where Democrats know how to hit their numbers, and they know, and they're better than McAuliffe in a lot of cases, worse than some at like refuting arguments early. But they, you can get shocked at the last minute. That's the Maloney story. Maloney has run tough races. Most of his races actually have been pretty tough, but he has not had at the very last minute, what might be, you know, in the end, like it's 4 million now, it might be much more than that, suddenly saying he wants all the criminals to kill you.
It's I mean, I feel like there's been races, there's been years in the past where these influx of money has been so dramatic and decisive. But I feel like this could be the year. And we almost saw like that APAC associated PAC. We talked to Ryan Grimm about this last week, the influence it had in these primaries. And we're seeing sort of like the next iteration of that. It feels like this late money, because we have, because there's so many billionaires out there who, you know, the idea of dropping $20 million, $50 million in the last couple of weeks of a campaign is really sort of like functionally like, you know, me saying I'm going to get a nice pair of boots for this winter. I mean, it's the same sort of effort. I am going to get a nice pair of boots, incidentally, for this winter.
Oh, good. Yeah, I should probably get some. Yeah, I have too. All these comfortable sneakers that are actually freezing.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't. They honestly, this is the thing. We're talking through Democrats' messaging, and I feel there was a lot of attention this last week to, oh, they're pivoting to Social Security and Medicare. Well, they've also been running on that. It is the issue is, are you talking about the thing that is on my TV at the moment? And that's something they can't really control. And frankly, you have a president who is not good at changing the subject to what he wants. I mean, Donald Trump could change the subject to stuff and it would become less popular. That might happen if Biden did it. But they're not running like campaigns that I think people will look back at and say, oh, they forgot to talk about this, except they're not trying anything bold. Nobody has tried, with the exception like a John Fetterman, Sanders, who's not running for something this year, nobody's really said, we can't like fight on this turf. We need to like take new ground and say, what about this policy that we will do if we win? They've kind of lost that because of the overwhelming Republican messaging advantage, just from TV to the rest of the press. I mean, really, just like watch any kind of interview. Like, I don't want to trash like other reporters, but I learned nothing from like these interviews with like White House staffers, because it's not like, what will this policy do? It is, can you respond to how bad you are? Interesting, I guess, but like, I don't know what the stakes of the election are when I hear that.
All right, let's run through some of these key Senate races, get a sense of what you're thinking in the Senate. In Georgia, Chuck Schumer says Walker is gaining on Warnock. What's your sense of that?
Yeah, I think that it is. Warnock has run a good campaign. Walker has run a very good consultant campaign. Every time he talks, he says things that are silly. But one factor there is that Republicans really have inculcated the idea that if there is a scandal about a Republican, it is fake. Like every scandal is Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas, which in the Republican cosmos was fake. And so you saw Republicans pretty boldly saying, you know, oh, well, Walker was accused of having an abortion. That's not because, paying for an abortion. That's not because he did. That's because liberals don't like him. And right. So they've locked in their base there. And it is entirely just our independents who are undecided on this convinced that Walker is competent enough to like be a senator who will fight inflation, you know, kind of very substance free. On that stuff, it's just like, can a mediocre candidate who voters kind of don't hate but don't think is good, can he just ride that by denying everything negative about him? That's been the story of that race.
Are you going to make a prediction? Because if you get enough right,
I think that'll still go to a runoff. I think that's going to piss everybody off by going to like a runoff that lasts for a month, not 2 months. They changed that law.
Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah, I think Johnson's got that. He's going to win that. It's not going to be huge, probably a single-digit win. Again, that's a state where it's very clear to voters that if Republicans win everything, or sorry, not as clear as Democrats want it to be, but it's from Republican campaigning and the bills they passed in the legislature, it's very clear that Republicans, if they take the state, would limit abortion, all that sort of stuff. Those issues are good for the statewide races. For the federal, I do think Barnes very early on was defined as a radical who hated cops, and he did not respond to it quickly. I'm not sure how he could have. But yeah, I think that I know Democrats have been starting to write that off for, I mean, before Barnes the nominee, this is a thing where Democrats very quietly were saying, we'd rather just some guy, some white guy, some generic Democrat is the nominee running this campaign than a, black lieutenant governor who said some things that can be turned into attack ads. So they've been pretty gloomy on it, and I think he's in trouble.
Pennsylvania.
I want to see a polling since the election, but that's a race where, like, the delta between...
Since the debate?
Yeah, yeah. The debate was like, bad for Fetterman. I think the spin the campaign did was, like, absolutely the best thing it could have done. I talked to Fetterman a week before that. This is really, like, if he loses that race, it's just bad. It's as much as, like, he had a bad night. When I interviewed him, he was stumbling over some words and mushing some stuff together. He had a worse night at that debate. He did, these hour-long editorial boards. You can watch the video if you don't trust me. He was not as bad as he was on the stage. So I think that did some damage to him. But, like, Oz has been so unpopular, and Oz at the last minute is doing something that, desperate candidates do, which is, like, people are already early voting, and he's saying... He's reintroducing himself as a moderate. You know, like, aren't you tired of the extremes in Washington? I'm not one of the extremes. He's doing this because his favorables are, like, in the 30s. People just don't like that this celebrity doctor who doesn't live in Pennsylvania came there to be a senator. So I feel like that is still a Fetterman advantage unless a lot of voters change their minds because of the debate.
New Hampshire.
That is close. I remember joking to Republicans, like, you guys are going to spend, like, $40 million to lose by 3 points. I still think that's going to happen. The issue that they keep hitting there is that heating oil prices are going up in the state. I mean, and they also, Ross Barkin has a good story in New York Magazine about this. Like, as soon as Don Boldick won the primary, Republicans just did like a My Fair Lady on him and said, okay, we have this candidate who has said some crazy stuff. We're just going to have him run like the same campaign every Republican is running. So I'm against inflation. I'm against high heating prices, yada, yada. I just think Democrats need to, like, lose some more ground. If Biden's approval in New Hampshire stays at, like, 45%, I'm not sure how many voters there are who want to replace every Democrat. So I think Hassan still has the advantage. But she was never going to win by a lot. She was always going to win. A month ago, she was going to win by, like, 6. Maybe now she wins by 3.
Nevada is a big one, right?
Yeah, I think that Republicans will win that. I haven't been there in a few months. I just think that is exactly where the party's problems with non-college educated, working class, white and Hispanic, and some black voters and Asian voters. I just think they're going to turn out Democrats. They are turning out Democrats at a very good rate. They're going to hold on to a lot. But all the evidence I see is the more like independent and lower propensity voters who are being turned out, they're going to vote Republican because all those factors I mentioned, and this has been written about, but just like Vegas was not the right place to have a shutdown that prevented tourism for a long time.
Right.
I mean, it was really devastating to a city that had like come back from a recession in people's memory. And Republicans have just been relentless. And there's states where that hasn't clicked. Hey, aren't you angry about what happened 2 years ago? And there's states where it has. And that's one of them. They're specifically with like working class voters who usually vote Democratic and they don't like Republicans, but they're like, I'm never going to forgive them for making me unemployed for a few months.
So that sort of Harry Reid mojo where Democrats go into the election week down in the polls and then all of a sudden they pull it out. That's gone now.
I think they will do okay, but I think they'll fall short.
Okay.
Just based on those patterns. Like, they still have a very good political operation. Republicans still have a very bad one.
So that's the key one, yeah. Because that's the one, that is a potential Democratic net would mean net loss. I mean, that is the only one where it, you know, it's a loss at this point. What about Colorado? Is that is there?
I haven't been there in a little while, but I've always been skeptical about that for the
Where are you hanging out, Dave? Like, you're not going to those two places?
I've flown over Colorado. Like, I mean, I was in, like, Texas and Oregon and back in D.C.
I'll ask you about Oregon next.
Anyway. But anyway, no, in Colorado, I think that is the opposite of Nevada, in that you have a ton of, like, college-educated white voters who need a good reason to not vote for Democrats, and you have a governor in Jared Polis, who did not lock the state down as much. And lockdown is like, that's a weighted term. But he was very, very vocal and early about, this is bad, this sucks, let's open up as fast as possible. And he was opening up when you were still, Democrats could still get, you know, blown up on Twitter for taking a mask off. He was doing that. So the Republican arguments in Colorado have just been like a little tone deaf. So he's been in good shape. He has an opponent who this is the race where his opponent insists that kids are being given litter boxes in schools. Like, that's kind of gone off the rails. And with you also have Joe O'Dea, who Republicans think is a great candidate. He's in this trap that a lot of Republicans get in a blue state, which is do you blow past a Trump question? Do you make something up, or do you say I wouldn't vote for him? And he said he wouldn't vote for him. He'd campaign against him. So he's just like not an exciting candidate for Republicans. His whole thing is convincing moderates. I don't think it's going to go in that direction. I think if things melted down for Democrats and, you know, gas went up to $20 next week, maybe. But I think the arguments that work for Republicans are not there.
Let's just jump to Oregon, unless you think that like there's a story that we should know in North Carolina, Iowa, or Florida.
Well, I mean, I know I've been following them a little less, but that you've got both parties kind of wish they could do like a Freaky Friday of their better candidates and their worst candidates. Like, you have very good Democratic candidates in Ohio and Florida. In North Carolina, Beasley, who some Democrats thought was like a little bit dry as a speaker. I mean, she's not, but you know, candidates being dry is a problem for journalists. It's not a problem for voters. They don't need to be interesting to like be electable. They're all very good candidates running very good campaigns, and just everything is mitigating against them. And then in Oregon, that's the race for governor, and it's the House races. That's one of those things I was talking about, where if you're in a blue state where Democrats have been running things for a long time, your problem is Republicans can say everything that's happened that you don't like is the Democrats' fault, and nothing will change if they win again. And that has been very powerful in Oregon.
Isn't there research out there that, like, in the wake of like hurricanes or massive storms or losses of like the football team, that incumbents will necessarily are at like a, I don't know, 1 or 2 point deficit in elections that take place within a certain? I mean, I wonder. You know, this is. I wonder if the COVID is having that impact in these areas where. That sort of almost like secular bad things have happened. People are not, you know, it's been a rough couple of years, and I'm going to blame the people who are there now, just because I'm mad about it.
I think that's on the margins that some of those things might affect. I think basically just like there's not any Democrat at this point getting totally taken by surprise. Like you mentioned, we mentioned Colorado. The thing with like Washington State, which Republicans have talked about the entire cycle, just because they hate Patty Murray and they don't understand why like a short woman who's not very exciting keeps winning. Like she didn't. She raised like normal amount of money and not like Raphael Warnock record breaking money or, you know, Mark Kelly record breaking money. So. There are like not the reasons why like, the things that would flip people there. Some of them exist. I mean, that is, but like the thing that it's just generally East Coast bias, like Washington had a pretty good pandemic experience. The decisions that were made during COVID were pretty popular. Seattle voters who are Democrats, like after they had a very high profile 2021 election where they replaced the city leadership and some of the concerns of crime went down. So I think a lot of, I bring that up because there are Democrats who I think you know, 4 years ago might have, or longer than that, 8 years ago might have run out of money and been surprised if something popped up at the last minute. And I don't think they're there anymore. I just think there are some people like Murray and Bennett who, if things got real crazy at the end, they don't have like FU money that they can dump in, like Warnock or Kelly or Fetterman.
All right, so Democrats hold the Senate?
No, I don't think so. I think Republicans will win by a couple.
So where is it that they're going to lose? Nevada?
I think Nevada. I think Georgia in a runoff is very possible. I think Pennsylvania or Arizona are both possible. I just think things would need to snap back for Democrats. And I mentioned Arizona. Couple times, not maybe sure in that sentence, but in Arizona, you just have, that's another one where like the Republicans have a very unpopular candidate who has a record that has been very easy to go after on TV. It's just, that is a place where there's enough people who are like, you know, as a working class person, I'm not paying a lot of attention, but nor should I, but like Republicans say they're going to fix these problems. So I'm going to vote for them. I think there's enough of that going. I'm literally about to head there. So I will see how correct I am, but I think it's easier for me to see a few races breaking their way. So they've got those seats. I mean, but the turnout so far, Democrats are doing well enough where I don't think there's going to be, just in 2014, everything broke against them.
Yeah.
And even in races where their candidates were popular, people were just like, forgot to vote. And that is not happening this year.
All right. Well, I hope you're wrong at the very least about the Senate.
I mean, and it, like the stakes of this are being not well reported. Like the fact that there will just like not be any more people confirmed to anything if there's a Republican Senate, I don't think is being very, very widely reported.
Oh my God.
Of the election.
If the Democrats lose the Senate, the only thing that's going to happen are going to be the investigations out of the House. That's mm-hmm. the only thing that will happen. There will be nothing will happen. You know, maybe there's a couple of things maybe he can do as an executive order. But, you know, half the White House staff is going to be dedicated towards the impeachment hearings. And so it's going to be rough. Dave Weigel, often a pleasure. I mean, today, not so, you know, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
It would have been more fun if you had thought that the Democrats were at least going to hold the Senate. But,
I mean, I'm out there. I'm seeing what is happening, and if things change, I can tell you. But that's
well. No, I appreciate that. I appreciate the frankness, but nevertheless,
if you want to come back on this show, you've got to tell us what we want to hear. Don't you understand?
Well, it's not just that. I mean, I'm just saying that, like, you're being honest, and I'm being honest, and it's like more often than not, it's a pleasure to have you on. And I'm just telling you what I'm reporting, which is today not as much of a pleasure.
Well, it's been a pleasure to speak with you either way. So thank you guys.
All right. Well, see, we're all just being honest here. It's just about honesty. Dave Weigel, really appreciate
Thanks,
it. I signed up for your newsletter the moment it went, even before it was live. So yes. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I think one went out while I was in here, unless I missed something.
Well, I haven't read it.
Thank you very much.
I've been doing this. All right. Have fun.
I asked Bernie what he thought of, if Tulsi Gabbard was like dividing the left with her campaign and right now, and he said, the answer is, David, my focus is on 2022. So he didn't want to talk about that. But we have a fun Bernie interview with some other stuff from Texas. Yeah, enjoy. It's a good issue this week or this Friday.
I'll check that out. We'll have plenty more to talk about that in the coming weeks, months, years. Dave Weigel, always a pleasure. We'll put a link to your newsletter at Semaphore.
Thanks.
Awesome.
All right,
thanks, guys.
Folks, we got to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be talking to Matthew Film Guy. And hopefully, you know, he'll be, I don't know, a little more upbeat.
A chore. Like
right.
Yeah. Weigel.
We get all the way through that. And Weigel's like, I mean, God.
I know.
We probably should have asked him beforehand. What do you, say? So I could brace myself for that.
Nevada is insanely concerning.
Yeah. Well, and apparently Georgia and Arizona. I mean, folks, good time to remind you, vote. Tell your folks to vote. Tell your friends to vote. 75% of this audience is younger than me. We have record-breaking early voting around the country, the one cohort who don't seem to be doing it are young folks. Now, let's not revert to those voting patterns of yesteryear where young people, like when I was young, people didn't vote when I was young, but younger people are more sort of in touch. And I get it. It's not electoral politics are not even necessarily the most important thing that will bring about change in this country, but they're a week and a half off. And right now, if you want to talk about changing the direction of this country, in the next 2 weeks, there is nothing more you can do than voting and getting other people to vote. Quick break. We'll be right back with Matthew Film Guy. Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, this song.
Matthew, the film guy, is choosing your streams. Cassavetes on Netflix and other such themes. Maybe you'll watch one and learn a few things. Please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew, please recommend me a movie.
I will.
Matthew! Film Guy! Film Guy!
That's my name that you gave me.
Matthew, it's true. I guess I did sort of name you.
You have anointed me, Matthew Film Guy.
Matthew Film Guy, always a pleasure to see you. Emma will be here back in just a moment. You are, and I can tell because I recognize the room. No, wait a second. What, oh, that's your office. I always think of of your bedroom because when we were editing back in the day, you would edit in your bedroom.
That's right. I've expanded.
Yeah, those were the days. Are you still in that same place?
That's right. Rent controlled since 1997. Thank you very much.
There you go. Matthew Film Guy. 25 years. But the last time we saw you, you were in California in some type of like safe house or something like that. It was a weird
bunker, antiseptic, THX style edit room. No, it was just an Airbnb in the middle of Beverly Wood.
Okay, and so remind us what you were there for and how it went.
I was out there editing another independent feature film called September 17th, directed by Brittany Snow. also written by her. It was, let me just say, a very intense, very, as always, draining, quite, I might even say stressful. I actually didn't leave that house very often. I think I may have related this. I was working, you know, 12 to 14 hour days to put this together. You know the old story, not enough money, not enough time, even some creative differences in there. I actually wound up going to the emergency room at Cedars-Sinai Hospital because what I thought was a massive pinched nerve in my neck, it turned out to be shingles, Sam.
Oh, no. So,
yeah. So I even worked on this movie going through shingles.
That is the one of the most incredibly painful things in the world.
You know, that's what they kept telling me, and I don't know if it's because I already take gabapentin, this drug for a pinched nerve that I've already had, if I got off a little light. So it wasn't, like, completely debilitating, but the whole half of my head was numb. It was something. It was something. So it was not fun. But, yeah, you know, that's what it takes to work in independent film.
Now, are you going to go out and get your shingles vaccine now, or are you just feeling like, I don't need to do that? Because you can get it again. It's apparently it's easier to get after the first time.
And also, not to make this the medical corner, disclaimers, Joe Rogan style, but I also saw that Australia had a study that said you're 15% more likely to get it after COVID. So I don't know if the fact that I had COVID also led me to be more susceptible to it. I'd only had it, I don't know, 2 months maybe before that. But yeah, I don't know. That's a good question, Sam. I'm going to contemplate that. I'm probably going to get my COVID booster and then decide if I'm going to get that.
I can tell you, I got the Shingrix. It's going to put you out for a day. I mean, it is. We talk about like side effects.
That sounds like a plus. That sounds like a plus.
My arm, I just remember, just like blew up to here. It made me look a little bit more like
swole,
broad chested. Yes.
Yeah.
I will say this, and then we'll move on from this. And I know that we've talked somehow. Fridays ends up like I'd say the number of times that shingles has come up on a Friday. I don't know why this is, but
because it's a casual Friday.
It's casual Friday. And,
and you bring it up is the thing.
Well, no, we had Andy Kindler on and he brought it up and that's how I
brought it up. You missed it. I actually got it while I was out in LA. So
I'm not saying like, hey, how are you? Have you caught shingles? I'm not
okay. I stand corrected.
And I don't say hi, everybody. I got shingles.
I will say this.
I sort of did.
The existence of shingles is what scares me about, COVID. Because shingles we get from the chickenpox virus.
Right.
You get it as a kid. It lives somewhere, I think, maybe in your spine or somewhere around there. I'm not exactly sure. It's a virus. And then it comes out 45 years later, 50 years later. And causes, you know, shingles, which is an extremely painful condition for everybody who's not already so, you know, hopped up on drugs that they can feel it. So I don't know.
What happened? My head was numb. It's still partly numb. Like it's still slowly receding. But like the worst part is like, you know, you can't like lay down on a pillow because it hurts when you touch it. It was very, very uncomfortable. But thankfully, I was sitting upright editing for 14 hours a day, so I didn't really have to lay on my head.
If you never got chickenpox as a kid, do you need the shingles vaccine?
That's a good question. I don't know. All I know is I was told that if you can't be around anyone who's never had chickenpox as a kid with shingles, because the only thing that is transmittable is you can give chickenpox to somebody if you have shingles. But if you had chickenpox, you cannot transmit shingles to somebody.
I never had it, so that's why I'm just curious.
Holy were your parents like one of those kinds of isolated anti-vax parents?
No, not at all. Well, I had
the
anti-vax vaccine.
People do the chickenpox parties.
Yeah, exactly.
What?
Oh yeah, you never heard of it? Well, I mean, not even anti-vax. Like back when we were kids, the idea was somebody's got chickenpox. Bring the kids over, get it over with, because when you're younger, it's actually less dangerous for you to contract chickenpox than as you're older. And so people would do it to prevent chicken. I don't know.
To get it over with. That's the idea. When you're young, because when you're older and you get it, you're fucked. Okay. Anyway.
But
I have good news. I have good news, Sam.
We're going to talk about
the Democrats. The Democrats are going to win the Senate.
Oh.
I'm here to just announce. They're going to win the Senate, and they're going to take the House again. So there you
Whoa.
Go.
All right. Well, Matthew Film Guy, you heard it here
Thank
first.
Thank you so much.
I've done no research okay. at all.
Of course not. Now, Matthew, you finished editing this film. I want to cut to the quick. We got too distracted by this health and beauty stuff.
Beauty?
Well, so you edited this film. Are they applying to film festivals? When can we see this?
I don't know. This is always the question. They're still doing some work on it now. We got an extension for the Sundance deadline. So last I heard, that is still on track to happen. And, you know, if you know the right people, you can extend that deadline fairly far.
The picture locked.
I don't know 100% if it is.
There's a little bit of intrigue in this. I mean, because generally when the editor, we're talking to the editor and he's 5,000 miles away, the picture's locked.
That's right. So I alluded to some creative differences, and that may be the situation there. Not so much with the director, but with maybe one of the producers. But listen, you know, at this stage, I got to be a little political about all the information that comes out. But I hope to be able to talk all about it once it gets into Sundance, once it's finalized and everybody gets to enjoy it. Because it's a great movie that I really hope people get to see. But you never know with these low-budget movies, even with, you know, so-called names in it and so on. There's just such a deluge these days that...
Tell me about it. I'm still waiting for Fits and Starts to come out.
What was that one?
I'm joking. It was a movie that Larry Murphy and I played cops. I mean, we were side characters.
Why is that? Really?
He didn't make it. I can't remember the name of the filmmaker.
But if he was in it and it's not seen the light of day, that just proves my point. So
I don't know. It's out there. I don't know if it's. I think you can stream it. I'm not sure. Matthew, what's next? Yeah. I mean, because having been involved in this business in the past, I know nobody cares about what you
That's
just
right.
did.
That's I want right. to know You're what you're doing as good next. As your next project.
Yeah.
Well, I've already interviewed for my next film. It's actually a very exciting one. I can't, you know, tell you too much about it, but it's going to be shot by the same DP who shot Black Bear. So I'm excited to work with him again. I'm a work for hire guy, so I'm at their whim. I hope to hear about that soon. But meanwhile, you know, I'm back in my New York groove. I'm doing my class. My eBay store is thriving again, thankfully, now that I'm done with all this film work for now. You know, teaching my classes. Like my pleasure, you know, so that's what's going on right now. I'm kicking back and enjoying the break in between foxholes, basically.
Maybe we keep talking about like putting, having you come to the office, maybe with a huge like truck and taking, we got audio equipment that we got to get like,
oh yeah. Yeah. Just, you know, just autograph it. That's all. Just, and it'll move right out the door.
Here's a
VCR signed by Sam Cedar.
What else do we need to know right now, Matthew, before we go into the you tell us what film we should watch portion of this?
Well, segment. I don't know if you wanted to dish a little bit about when I hung out with Marin in L.A. because.
Oh, yeah. Let's hear that.
When last we talked, I was just about to see him.
I should just remind people I think most people know this who listen to the show, but. Mark Maron and I have been good friends for now 30 years, I guess. And in 2008, we ended up doing a show with Air America. We were both at Air America. We ended up doing a ill-fated video show that couldn't have been structured in a way to fail more. There's a whole story behind that I'm not going to get into. Matthew was an editor on the show and then became like a character on the show. That's not where you and I met. You and I met 20 some odd years ago when I hired you as an assistant to help me direct a movie. And then I hired you to play my assistant in the movie so that I could never like look around. Where's Matthew? He's right here on set with me because you were supposed to follow me around both as an actor and the actual director. And that worked out quite well, except for the movie was a disaster.
Yeah, so, with the exception of that. But otherwise, awesome.
And so you went out, you saw Marin out there, and you did his podcast. Is that right?
I did do a bonus episode of WTF. If you're a subscriber, you can go and hear that. It was sort of a recap of what we used to do on the show in the early days, you know, before he figured out how to make the podcast successful. He would interview different people. But the best part, actually, I have to tell you, is I don't know how familiar you are with the band Pavement. Sam, yes. The indie rock band from the 90s.
Sure.
I had the notion while we were there, I get like one night a week out, and I saw that they were playing. And I had tickets to see them in Brooklyn, but I was going to be gone, so I had to get rid of those tickets. So I was going to miss one of my favorite bands of all time. And I saw, oh, they're in L.A. I called up Maren, and I said, do you want to go see Pavement? I think there's probably still tickets available. And he wrote, I'll text Malcolmus. I forgot he had actually interviewed Stephen Malcolmus, the lead singer, on WTF. And next thing you know, we're getting VIP seats in the balcony and going backstage and hanging out. And it was like, and even Dean and Britta from Galaxy 500 were in the
backstage. Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. It was like a real cool 90s rock and roll experience. And, you know, I was still home by 11:30, which is nice, but it was incredible. And the band was amazing. And you know, you sit in these balcony seats. I sent another link. You can kind of see where we were, but it was like a dream experience, all thanks to the generosity of one Mark.
Oh,
wow. That is very sweet. Galaxy 500 was one of my favorite bands back in the day.
I know that.
Yep. Wow. That's great. And all those bands, the great thing about those bands now is they all do their shows. I was supposed to go see Buffalo Tom, but you know, they rescheduled it and I wasn't there. And the great thing about those shows is they design them for people my age. So the show starts, you know, doors open at like 5:30 and, and you're home in time before you fall asleep.
There are seated theaters and such. Yeah. Oh, I really appreciate it. And the band, they were amazing. They were as good as they have ever been. They sort of had a reputation as being sort of a shambles live, but like the 25 years plus of learning to play their instruments has only helped. So they put on just an incredible rock show, Pavement.
That's the whole Maren story. There was no drama or anything. He was nice and he set you up at a.
Well,
like,
I don't believe that.
He did want me to tell you he said hello.
That's it.
In a threatening way or?
Tell him Maren says hello. No, we always talk about you though, Sam. You know.
Okay, out of 10, relative to where, let's say, 10 was where he was when we were working with him in 2008. What is the level of neuroses and like where would you put him?
Well, I would still say about a 7, but it's just sort of shifted what it's about. Does that make sense?
Sure.
So yeah. He's no longer really so worried about his professional and creative life, but there's
it's got to be hypochondria, right? Like he's got to be concerned that
I'm not going to get too deep into the details, but you can, you know, imagine what a normal.
There's no doubt in my mind. He doesn't take a step without thinking that he's just like caught cancer.
And don't also forget, he's also a father to these cats. I think he worries about his cats, which is actually kind of sweet, very much. So there's some decision there. But yeah, I got to hang out with him a little bit. I got to enjoy his ridiculously expensive stereo system, which is, you know, his midlife crisis stereo system.
Yep.
So, it was nice. It was great. And, you know, to the extent that we said anything about you, it was like, you know, 50-50, positive, negative.
I take that as a win.
Yeah.
I definitely 100%. Take that as a win. I'm surprised. 100%. I'm surprised that I broke 50. So I'm, you know, it broke.
Well, I didn't say who was on what side, but yeah, it was.
Oh, okay. I see. You guys were arguing back and forth. All right. So now, Matthew, what are we going to do here about streaming a film here? What do you think? I should just say this. I recently saw Shazam for the first time from 2019, and I was impressed. And Saul was too. Saul really enjoyed it. It was our last movie night.
Superhero movie.
It was a superhero movie, but it is. There's a little bit of pathos in the film. And also there's a little bit of like, it's not so supernatural, you know, as you would think. Like it is a little bit supernatural, but it keeps it in line where it's like everybody's surprised that there's this supernatural thing as opposed to like all the Marvel stuff where it's like, we're just supposed to accept that there's multiple parallel universe and everybody gets it and, whatever.
Yeah, listen, I'm just counting the days until this segment becomes the Saul Cedar movie corner. So,
well, he's going to be here with you, and that's going to be
I see. Well, I'm glad you liked Shazam, which means now you're ready to see the one with The Rock. What's it called?
Black Adam.
Black Adam. That's
Heard it's bad.
Okay. I mean,
what else we got? What can we watch? Like, I'm going to probably have a chance to watch something maybe by myself this weekend. So we'll see.
Honestly, I don't necessarily have something for you per se, Sam, because your frequency is so sort of narrow. But I have two movies that I saw recently. One was the first movie that we showed to my class, which, you know, we go for the big, heavy, soul searing, challenging kind of works of art, masterworks of the history of cinema. So that's not necessarily going to be a feel good movie, but it actually is, I think, one of the best sort of war movies. And it's sort of only obliquely a war movie really ever made. And it's called The Ascent by the Russian filmmaker, Laura Shapitko. And, she died tragically in a car crash, at 41, but she managed to make this movie, which is, I'm sorry, her name's Larissa. I knew I misspoke. Larissa Shapitko. And it's basically about two soldiers in the Russian army in World War II who get separated from their unit. And they, you know, the way I'll pitch it is that it becomes a sort of a meditation on death and what morals might mean in terms of a living death. They get captured, and the one who's sort of the strong Rambo type, starts to crack, and sort of the weaker, sickly one who's not really good at war finds a sort of moral fortitude in the face of the torture and the sort of interrogation. And it's just, it's an incredible movie. It has a lot of very sort of overt religious allegorical imagery, which is not always my favorite, but it so fits the tone of the movie and it's so compelling. And it really avoids that thing that, I don't know if you've ever heard this quote, Francois Truffaut always said, like, there's no such thing as a truly anti-war movie, because there's always some exciting moment, some glorious moment, something in it that makes you just feel excited by it. So it's hard to really have a anti-war movie, but this one really does its job in making it seem like just the utter breakdown of all sort of human values and goodness. And it's in the area that, you know, some of the shit's going on right now. It's actually in Belarus is where this takes place. In World War II, which was massively wiped out by the Nazis and even by some of the conscriptions of the Russian army. So I highly recommend that. It's not light viewing. It's probably not one to watch with Saul for the next, I don't know, 10 years maybe. But I just was really impressed by it. And that's on the Criterion channel, and you can probably find it elsewhere too.
It's called The Ascent.
The Ascent, yes. Now, changing complete gears, for the majority of people out there who actually enjoy comedies still, and this is the problem with you, Sam, is I don't think you're programmed not to enjoy comedies anymore. But I was recommended a movie on another podcast that I occasionally do, the guys at the Movie Night Extravaganza. I'm sorry.
Why do you got to do that?
Well, because I would be remiss if I didn't give credit where credit is due. I would never have even thought of seeing this movie. It's got a lot of SNL sort of alum, and it's got a real kind of madcap sort of style, but it never gets cheesy. It never gets too cheap. It has some
Cannonball
sort of
Run.
It, you know what? I would put it up there with Cannonball Run. I really would. If you like Cannonball Run, check out Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar.
I love that movie.
I started to watch it on the airplane coming back from LA.
When was this movie made? I never even heard of it.
It came out in the pandemic. I'm kind of obsessed with it.
Barb and what?
Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar.
Go to Vista Del Mar. It is like there's several kinds of laughs, some laughs through tears. I mean, it's really like, it's just like what you want out of this kind of a movie. It's silly, but it's also kind of insightful into human foibles. Kristen Wiig is sort of the main stars, as someone you'd know, but it's got a lot of other SNL sort of orbiting people in it. And it's a great one. I could not recommend it any more highly. If you're looking for a real just comedy to take your mind off of how the Democrats
savvy is appropriate for a savvy 9-year-old or no?
It's got a lot of sexual innuendo and a lot of issues of the sexual sort. So I'd say definitely.
The thing about this movie is what is so crazy about it too, is like, I think they were excited to release it because it was the follow-up to Bridesmaids, because it was written by Kristen Wiig and Annie Mumlow, who both star in it. Right. And they were ramping it up to be this big summer comedy, I think, and then the pandemic hit, and then it went straight to video streaming and lost a ton of money. So people don't really know about it, but I thought it was really great because it was, it's one of those comedies that you haven't seen, I mean, in a really long time, studio comedies, where it commits like a lot to just surrealism and silliness, where I feel like in the Judd Apatow era, everything's kind of looser and shaggier and people are riffing off one another. And so that's kind of been the mold. But it reminded me of almost like an older style of comedy that, you know, my parents used to show me from the 70s or 80s when I was a kid, you know, a kid.
Like Cannonball Run.
Maybe like that. So I don't know. I've
actually
seen that
even
one,
had some sort of Python-esque sort of absurdity in it, you know, real left turn kind of moments that just make no sense in the sort of like Life of Brian where they wind up in the spaceship and then come back and the movie just continues. So I really give him credit for, like you say, committing to that just ridiculousness. And yet it also is about these two middle-aged women in like, you know, we would not think of a commercial prospect of like, let's make a movie about two middle-aged women looking for love after their heartbreaks and their sort of losses. So that's just a great points for that, for just choosing that as your starting point.
Well, they got probably free reign because Bridesmaids like broke the, you know, scales on how much a comedy can make in theaters, and so they were able to do whatever they wanted, and I feel like it shows. It's a weird movie, but it's I didn't know
that about its pedigree from Bridesmaids, but yeah, that makes a lot of sense that they really do seem to have had free reign here, and it shows you that there is still some weird sort of you know, just like a fateful moment that can appear randomly where people have the power because of that to do something somewhat idiosyncratic, even though it's in this sort of madcap wacky genre. So yeah, get to that while you can.
I'm so glad you said that.
I gotta say, Matthew, this is you really hit the gamut today.
I try to hit the gamut every time.
Ascent on one hand and Barb and Star go to Vista Del Mar.
Yep. Yeah. Two films that have almost nothing in common with each other, except you will enjoy them if you see them for different reasons.
Well, Matthew Film Guy, as always, an incredible pleasure. Folks can go and check out your, when's the next Learning Annex class start up again?
It just started this week, but you can jump on at any time. Prorated. Yep. So it's, you can go to the link at my Twitter, which is at Langdon Boom. You can also check out my eBay store, which is there, which has all kinds of great crap that I'm cleaning out. And also check me out at Letterboxd. You know, by the way, Dave Weigel is sort of a film guy himself. I don't know if you realize he's got a pretty big presence on Letterboxd too.
I don't
always agree with his takes, but they're interesting and they're from a sort of political angle. But yeah, Letterboxd is a fun place to talk movies if you're feeling like doing that, and I'll be there.
I think people are going to be shopping around for a new Twitter. It could end up being Letterboxd.
You know, you don't get to chit-chat in between people as much.
Not yet.
Yeah.
We'll add that feature as people are migrating looking for their new Twitter.
I would like that. I'm still holding it down on Facebook, too, but that's usually just for people. Really,
oh, wow. What's
you're that guy, then.
You?
All right.
I got to touch my mother somehow. Okay, yeah.
Matthew, Film Guy, let's get in touch about moving some product on eBay.
You got it.
All right.
Thanks, guys. Good to see
Always
you.
Always a pleasure.
Yep. Thanks, Matthew.
Okay, folks. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will take your phone calls. We will take your IMs. Maybe we'll take some phone calls. We'll see. We got a couple people holding on the line. Maybe we'll take them. They're already, they've been waiting. Forgot to put on the voicemail. Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. When you become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, you help this show survive and thrive. And then on top of that, you get the free show free of commercials. And then you get the fun half. It's a win-win-win. We've already outlined how many wins that is. So check it out. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Emma, what's happening on ESPN?
Well, yesterday, Bradley and I gave our picks for the NFL weekend. We also spoke about the feud between Bill Belichick and the starting quarterback, Mac Jones, how maybe Bill's style of militarism is not necessarily gelling anymore with the modern NFL and player empowerment. So that's an interesting conversation. But Bradley's already up after Thursday Night Football because he picked the Ravens. I didn't because I went against my gut. God damn it, I'm losing. And I'm freaking out. So you can witness that on youtube.com/ESVN show. And it's been a painful few weeks for me because Bradley's like hotter than I've ever seen anybody in a few weeks span with his picks. So
maybe put some money on this.
youtube.com/ESVN show.
Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leck in media universe?
Last night I was on with Jason and Pascal and Kuba of This Is Revolution on both the Left Reckoning feed and the This Is Revolution feed talking about, I bashed comics. Ooh. I talked about Alan Moore, the guy who made Watchmen and V for Vendetta, saying like he's not doing comics anymore because it's infantilized and, you know, adult should not be lining up for Batman movies. I threw that out to Jason Pascal because to me, like, Alan Moore is sort of like a Candace, like if I was a right wing racist, Alan Moore would be like the Candace Owens. Like, I already am predisposed to not like comic books. So having a comic book guy say, I hate comic books.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
I want to see if comic book likers actually buy that too. And so we had a discussion about culture. We talked about like why Westerns were popular during the Vietnam War and that sort of stuff. So check that out, folks.
All right. Quick break. We'll be back in just a moment. You can IM us through the app at majorityapp.com.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
You bring back DJ Dinner.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on!
Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am in total.
Pussy.